The following Aloud podcast was recorded live in 2008 at the historic Central Library in the heart of downtown LA as part of the award-winning Aloud series presented by the Library Foundation of Los Angeles. Aloud podcasts are made possible through the generosity of the law firm Arent Fox and by individual contributions from listeners like you. For more information on Aloud, or to find out how you, too, can support the Los Angeles Public Library, please visit our website, www.aloudla.org.
Eleanor Coppola is an award-winning documentary filmmaker, artist, wife, and mother. She directed the celebrated documentary Hearts of Darkness, A Filmmaker's Apocalypse, about the making of Apocalypse Now, which premiered on the Showtime cable channel in 1991 and was released on DVD last December. It's a very powerful film. She was awarded for that film an Emmy for Outstanding Individual Achievement in Directing. Her first book, Notes on the Making of Apocalypse Now, was hailed by Pauline Kael as the most lucid account of the strain of epic movie making we'll ever get. Eleanor Coppola graduated in applied design from UCLA. She met her future husband there, Francis Ford Coppola, while filming Dementia 13 in 1962, for which she was an assistant art director. In her new book, Notes on a Life, she takes us deep into her private life and reveals herself as a strong, complex woman who struggles to keep family and work, triumph and tragedy in balance. I'm sure many of you saw the wonderful review in the LA Times today, which lauded the book for its scrupulous honesty and its lucid, thoughtful prose. I couldn't agree more. In conversation with Eleanor Coppola tonight is her friend and very accomplished costume designer, Deborah Nadelman Landis. Deborah's costume design credits include Animal House, The Blues Brothers, Raiders of the Lost Ark, Michael Jackson's Thriller, and Coming to America, for which she was nominated for an Academy Award in 1988. Deborah has an MFA in costume design from UCLA and a PhD in the history of design from the Royal College of Art in London. She teaches at the USC School of Cinematic Arts, AFI, and she is a professor at the University of the Arts in London. She's the author of Screencraft, Costume Design, and she's edited 50 Costumes, 50 Designers, Concept to Character. Her latest book is Dressed, A Century of Hollywood Costume, and we have some copies of that very beautiful book on sale tonight, along with Eleanor's new book, courtesy, as I said, of our library store. So now, please join me in welcoming Deborah Landis and Eleanor Coppola to the Los Angeles Public Library. Thank you.
Thanks so much, Louise. Thank you all for coming tonight. And I welcome my friend, Eleanor Coppola. And we're going to start this reading, Notes on a Life. And Eleanor's going to start right at the beginning, right?
Okay.
Page 48, 49.
Just to tell you that the house I'm describing is a big, old Victorian house in the Napa Valley. April 4th, 2002, Napa. In late February of 2000, I was alone in the house. Early one morning, I was awakened by a thunderous cracking sound and felt the house shaking violently. I thought it was an earthquake, the big one. I leapt out of bed, intending to hurry and stand in a doorway. When I was fully upright, the noise and shaking suddenly stopped. It was strangely silent. I noticed the room was darker than usual. Then I saw the windows were covered with leaves and realized a branch of the giant valley oak in front of our house must have fallen. I grabbed my robe and put it on as I ran downstairs. The entry hall was dim. More foliage screened out the light. I hurried to the back door and out onto the porch. A worker was running in from the vineyard, his brown face ashen gray with fear. He had come to carry out the dead lady. Then he saw me, and his body slumped like rubber in relief. I walked around to the front lawn. It wasn't a branch. The whole giant oak tree had fallen on the house. Huge limbs had gone through the roof of the third floor into the room above my bedroom and through the walls of the bedroom next to mine. Branches surrounded my room so closely they had broken the screens, but miraculously not the antique rolled glass windows. Upended roots appeared to claw the air, and enormous branches looked as if they were grasping the house. It seemed unreal, as if it were a set for a horror film. I expected to see Roger Corman dash across the lawn, pleased with the look of it, complimenting his art department, anxious to get the first shot. I felt giddy. I was alive. My legs were trembling. I sank down onto the wet lawn. Just days before, the house had been full of family and friends, every room occupied. I called Francis in Reno, where he was on a retreat working on a script. He likes to go there where he can stay up all night, be able to order 24-hour room service, go down to the casino and see people, activity, any time of the day or night. The phone rang a long time. He answered it groggily. He was heartsick at the news and hugely relieved that no one was hurt. I called the children. It was as if we had lost a treasured member of the family. All of us had swung on the old swing that hung from the huge low branch, had Easter, harvest, and birthday parties in its shade. Each year we watched the seasons change on the tree. We saw the leaves fall and the gardeners rake them for wheat for days. We enjoyed winter sun through the bare branches, admired the thick green moss that grew on its north side, saw buds form and tender pale leaves appear and grow into dark leathery summer shade. In February 2000, it had rained an unusual 22 days. The tree was very heavy and apparently older and weaker than we knew. The rain-soaked earth suddenly sank on the side next to the house and the tree fell over. We had the rings counted. It was 308 years in age. Our house was built in its shade in 1885. We have lived in it since 1977, when we returned from the Philippines after Francis made Apocalypse Now. While the restoration of the exterior was being completed, Francis and I stayed in the house, sometimes doubting our wisdom as the pounding and sawing began each morning promptly at 7, and the workmen talked about what they'd done the night before as they repaired the roof outside our bedroom window. Now we're moving out so they can do an extensive renovation of the interior, creating new bathrooms and closets from several small bedrooms, updating the plumbing, electric, and heating systems. We're going to install a handsome elevator to access the redesigned wine cellar in the basement and two new guest rooms on the third floor. I have begun sorting, discarding, and packing all the things that the family accumulated over 25 years. Everything must be taken out of the house. During construction, Francis and I will be temporarily in a small caretaker's apartment a few hundred yards away.
And I wanted to start with that passage about this oak tree, because throughout the book, Ellie really talks about her connection to the land. And the book is as much about her relationship with nature, I feel, as her relationship with her family. Can you talk a little bit about the oak and about your property up in Napa?
Well, we live in Rutherford, which is almost the center of the Napa Valley. And when we first went there in 1977, I was accustomed to living in San Francisco, and I loved the city and going to art galleries and going to dance concerts, and I really was very frustrated by the idea of moving to the country. But Francis was, he's the Italian dictator husband, and he said, we're moving to the country, and of course we did. And I was really unhappy about it. But after about 6 months, I found that nature had this incredible drama and this beauty and this interest to me. I was just enthralled with the changing of the sky and the light and the seasons, and the daffodils would come up and the wild mustard would bloom and the new leaves would begin in the vineyard, and the fall was extraordinary. Just every part of it, I became this just so intrigued by nature and the creatures. We have deer, we have wild turkeys, we have lizards, we have snakes, we have rabbits. Just It really changed my life, and I didn't know. I'm actually a Taurus, and somehow this being in nature just really struck me very deeply in my heart, and was just a revelation.
Well, also what interests me is this. You're an iconic movie family, and the fact that you live on a farm, and it's not a Beverly Hills farm either. You live on a farm, and there's a tension between life in the movie business and living this bucolic life. Do you think so, or not so much?
Well, I think they balance each other, you know, in a way that we go away, and we have this, like, all these interesting travels and exciting da-da-da-da, and then we come back and kind of regroup and just cook in the kitchen and walk and eat and have a side that I think would be really missing if we lived in the heart of Beverly Hills.
Yeah, although you know I have a beehive.
Oh, no, I don't know these things.
Yeah. So, you know, you can have a beehive in Beverly Hills.
Well, they have vineyards in Bel Air, you know. They have a very good winery,
So if you ever want to leave Napa, you can. There's, you know, the hills of Beverly, that kind of thing. Let's move on to page 56. And we're in, let's see, May 15th, 1998, Los Angeles, page 56.
Yes, she set the date. The structure of this book moves backwards and forwards in time, and I felt like I wanted to make it more like The Mind Thinks. It's a memoir, but it doesn't start when I'm six and end when I'm 6,000. It starts, it goes back and forth and in and out of a timeline, because I just feel like that's the way I am, and that's the way I think, and that something reminds me of something, and that sends me back, and then comes back to current time, and so forth. So the dates are relevant because it kind of places where I am or what I'm speaking about. So this is quite a bit earlier than the last piece. May 15th, 1998, Los Angeles. I'm outside having brunch in the courtyard of the Polo Lounge at the Beverly Hills Hotel. My feet hurt in my two tight patent leather loafers. I'm sorry I wore them. Francis and Sophia are seated across from me, talking intently. I'm looking at the light falling on the centerpiece bouquet of miniature orchids and their pattern of shadow on the white tablecloth. I can smell star jasmine climbing the columns, supporting the mushroom-shaped roof over our heads. I hear the clinking of silverware on china plates, punctuating the murmur of conversation woven together around me. Yesterday was Sophia's birthday. She turned 27. She is beautiful in an imperfect way. Her brows are pinched together as she concentrates on what Francis is telling her and writes notes in the red leather agenda he gave her for Christmas. She is going to direct her first feature film starting next month. It is a low-budget production with a script Sophia wrote from a book called The Virgin Suicides. I can hear Francis say, "Sit right next to the camera so the actors can see you. See you're in control. Remember, the actors' hands are almost as important as their faces. Hands are very expressive. If you cut hands out of the frame, you're losing 30% of the performance." I'm very happy for Sophia, happy that Francis is being such a good father and mentoring her. But I also feel a hot, aching jealousy in my chest. I'm trying to just notice my emotions, the way I was instructed in Zen meditation, to neither wallow in them nor push them aside. My father died when I was 10. I felt handicapped as I made my way into the adult world without his support and guidance. My mother gave me good values, but she couldn't help me in the outside world. She didn't go beyond her home. Her sisters-in-law were all excellent homemakers, good cooks and seamstresses, made jams, casseroles, and curtains. My mother wasn't interested. She was considered eccentric and fought depression. She wanted to be a librarian and spend her days with books, But work wasn't an option in her marriage, in her day. She read a lot and neglected her housework. My teenage rebellion consisted of baking perfect lemon meringue pies, sewing all night, and working two summer jobs, things my mother didn't do. As a young adult, I longed for my father. He had gone to art school in France, worked in Mexico, and been a political cartoonist for the Los Angeles Examiner. I felt terrified as I dropped out of college for a year, traveled in Europe, and changed my major to art. I imagine my father would have encouraged and mentored me. Francis and I married quickly in Las Vegas. I hadn't met Francis's parents. When I did, I learned he was from generations of Italian men who believed a woman's life's work was caring for home and children and supporting her husband's career. Francis knew I had artistic aspirations, but expected they could be pursued at home in my spare time. By the early 70s, we lived in a big house with our three young children. I was no longer interested in making lemon pies. My thoughts were about conceptual art and pushing the boundaries of what sculpture could be. In our son Roman's nursery school carpool, I discovered another mother was artist Lynn Hirschman. She thought my ideas were interesting. We had intoxicating conversations and created several conceptual art events together. One of our more infamous was held in 1975 in our 22-room Victorian house in San Francisco. 50 board members from the Los Angeles County and the San Francisco Museums of Modern Art came. When they arrived, Lynn and I were out of sight, downstairs in the screening room with a closed-circuit television connection to the living room. We spoke to our visitors over a large monitor. They could converse with us, but only interact with our electronic images. We invited them to take a self-guided tour of rooms in the house where we had placed exhibits. I knew the audience wasn't as interested in our art as they were in coming to Francis Ford Coppola's house, where it was known he kept his 5 Oscars. In those days, when a man won an Oscar, a miniature Oscar was given to his wife to wear in a chain around her neck. I had a jeweler file off the little loop from the chain at the top of the head of my 5 tiny Oscars, then removed Francis's from the lighted glass case where they were always kept and displayed my miniature gold statues in their place. In an upstairs bedroom, Lynn exhibited Margot St. James, the president of an organization attempting to unionize prostitutes. Coyote, call off your old tired ethics. I paid Roman and Sophia to stay in Sophia's bedroom with a TV monitor playing a video of her birth. There was a cord across the open door and a sign that said, "The artist's most important work, expected to take 21 years to complete." On the long wall of the second floor hall, I hung a series of 50 photos I'd taken of my friend Joyce Goldstein standing in front of her closet wearing different clothes from underwear to evening wear. She was on hand that night, continually appearing in different outfits. In the kitchen, the guests were directed to peel a potato and then read a quote from the artist Joseph Beuys, which said, "Peeling a potato can be a work of art if it is a conscious act." There were 2 large cooking pots labeled art and not art. Each guest had to decide whether his or her peeled potato was art or not and drop it in the appropriate pot. Francis was out of town when Lynn and I staged this event. From what he heard about it, he saw neither the art in it nor the humor. His feelings were hurt. He thought I was making fun of him, his Oscars, our house. He worked long and hard on his films, and he thought conceptual art was too easy. So some guy shoots himself in the arm, Chris Burden, or pisses off a ladder in a gallery, Tom Marioni, and that's a big deal? The only thing Francis finds okay about that period is a Joseph Beuys sculpture I bought him that he didn't like at the time, but is now worth 30 times what I paid. I was not a good wife by his definition or mine.
And are you now?
You'd have to ask him.
I mean, how did that... But I'm interested in how it played out. How did you make peace with that that, I mean, did he come around to your artwork?
Yes, I think he has finally, over the years, I think I tried to kill off that aspect of myself because it's really a nuisance, it's really in the way, and it gets in the way of all the things that I could be doing, should be doing, would be doing for the family, for the businesses, for all of the other aspects of my life. But it just doesn't go away, and I think finally I've had to accept it and he's had to accept it.
Just because there isn't enough hours in the day to manage all of that and then do art? Is that what you mean?
Well, I just sort of force my art upon my situation and the family and whatever. I just keep doing it. Once I read a book in the 70s by Judy Chicago, who had gone around and interviewed all these women artists, and they made their art on top of the washing machine on the back porch. They made it when their kid was taking an hour nap. They did it on the kitchen table, wherever. They just forced it into the little gaps in their life, and I feel like that's what I did. And in retrospect, I think some people who have too much time or too much freedom or whatever, they never get anything done. So whatever I got done was just what I was able to do in those intermittent gaps.
Allie, can I ask you how you wrote this book? Did you write it on the run? Did you write it on a laptop? Did you write it on post-it notes, on index cards? When did you write the book? How did you write that? How did the book come about, and how did you actually get it written?
Well, I began writing these kinds of notes during the making of Apocalypse Now, and I started because I was really alone and lonely. When we went to the Philippines, Francis was in this sort of creative fervor, and I was there by myself, taking care of the kids, kind of finding their school, da-da-da, all the things you do. And I had left my women friends, these artists that I was working with, and I was so, alone. I started writing letters, I thought, but they were really these notes, and I'd send them to friends, and they'd say, oh, send more. They were interested, and I used them sort of to keep my place for the documentary material I was shooting. And so after that experience was over, I just kind of kept that habit up. It seems like a kind of, I just have the urge when I'm somewhere, I overhear a bit of conversation, or I'm in some exotic experience and I'm kind of like wondering how I got here at the table of the Queen of Thailand or whatever it happens to be. And so I keep writing these notes, and they were just piling up and piling up. And my mom, who's 99 now, she had a habit all during her life of writing. Every morning when she woke up, she would write like three or four lines of kind of a meditation that would sort of come to her in the early moments of her day. And she had shoe boxes full of these things, and we kept saying, Mom, you know, you ought to edit these and pull these together. They would interest some other people, and da-da, and she'd say, oh, not now, I'm not ready. And finally, she became too old, and it didn't happen. And I thought, oh, my God, I've got all these notes piling up in scraps of paper that I tend to write, like, on the back of an envelope in my purse or on a receipt or whatever scrap of paper thing that's around. And I said, what are my kids are going to do with these? They're going to just be stuck with this stuff, and maybe I should see if I can assemble a group of them together in some order that would make sense to someone else.
That's a good segue, talking about Apocalypse Now, to the next reading, which is page 236.
July 10th, 2004, Napa. Marlon Brando died last week. Random memories of him have been coming to mind. When Francis started shooting Godfather in the spring of 1971, I didn't meet the film's fabled star right away. There were major production difficulties, with rumors that Francis would be fired or Marlon would be. I was occupied with our two young boys, Roman 5 and Gio 7, and very pregnant with Sophia. We were living in a small, cramped apartment in New York City. It belonged to a relative, and we were there rather than leasing a place in case Francis lost his job and we suddenly returned to California. One evening during the second week of May, George Lucas and his wife Marcia were visiting, waiting for a night flight to London to begin a backpacking trip through Europe. Francis was still at work. We were sitting around the kitchen table looking at my huge belly. George said, "You could have it on my birthday, you know, it's tomorrow." We laughed. They left around 8 p.m., and about an hour later I began having labor pains. I called the production office. Someone was sent to find Francis. He was in the screening room watching dailies. I called the doctor. He said, "Well, come in after midnight. If you come in before, you'll have to pay for a full day today." It sounded right. We didn't have much money. When Francis got home around 10 p.m. and saw me experience a few pains, he said, "We're going." Francis was born at 2 a.m. on George's birthday. When she was about 3 weeks old, I took her to the Godfather set. The production was shooting in the garden of a big house on Staten Island. It was the wedding party scene. Marlon was waiting in one of the upstairs bedrooms. His makeup man and hairstylist were with him. Francis introduced me. It was the first time I really understood what charisma was. Marlon took my hand and looked at me with such charm. He spoke in that voice. I felt as if I were standing in a special beam of light, and he found me utterly fascinating. It was a fleeting moment, as I imagine a hit of heroin to be. Stunning, short-lived, and dangerously seductive. Then Marlon turned to Sophia. He lifted her out of my arms so tenderly, holding her with an ease that only comes from experience. He looked at her with intense interest, examining her long fingers and tiny toes. A few days later, a little gold bracelet arrived. The card said, "Dear Sophia, welcome to the world. Love, Marlon." Somewhere over the years, the card and the bracelet have been lost, but I still write, "Welcome to the world," on baby gifts I give.
So my feeling, I'd like to respond to something you said just before, which was, is it true or isn't it true that you wake up every day and say, "What an extraordinary life"? Are you ever not surprised about your life?
Aren't we all surprised about our life?
I don't know.
Whatever form it takes.
I don't know because, I mean, my question right now would be, when you were at UCLA and you met this young guy, and you started your lives together. Did you date at all? Was it the days of dating, or did you just move in?
Oh, please, it wasn't the days of moving in.
That was me. I forgot.
Well, you're too young.
Yeah, I know. So what happened? I mean, and how quickly did he become successful? Was it right away? And how did you take this wild ride? Because I know that your life's been a roller coaster, a big, big roller coaster. But how do you take your life from your mom, from what you were at your mom's house, and meeting Francis, falling in love with Francis, and then holding on really hard to those coattails, and holding on and keeping on the ride? Can you talk to me a little bit about that beginning?
Well, I was a student at UCLA, and I had a friend who was a cinematographer, and he told me he was going to work on a low-budget film in Ireland. And I said, "Gee, can you get me a job? That sounds really fun." And so he did get me a job as the assistant to the art director, and I had to pay my way there, and I got paid $100 a week and got room and board. And in the course of it, I met Francis, was the writer and director of this project, and it was really low budget. I mean, I'm talking $20,000. And we became friends first because he was working, he had an Irish girlfriend, and I think that foundation of becoming a friend and working together really is a touchstone, sustained us over all the years. And then when we came back from that trip, yes, we did date for about 6 months, and got married, and I thought he was going to make like little low-budget black and white, like little films that people made in those days.
And well, he was a Roger Corman director.
Yeah, he was. Yeah. Yeah, because after that we went. I worked on. I just can remember making some witch's hut for some Roger Corman film that he was working on, and I thought that's what our life was going to be like. So we had two children right away, and Francis's career just took off, and I was in total shock. I just didn't expect
that. What was
that.
Francis's first big hit?
Well, the first film after that he made was You're a Big Boy Now, and that was a full-blown feature film shot in New York, and it was his master's thesis for UCLA. So it was the first time a film student had made a film, a person coming out of film school. The jobs had always gone to people in the industry. Old men.
Old men, he was the young one.
That's true. He was the youngest person. And he was sort of an inspiration then to other film students, because his next film after that was Finian's Rainbow, and George Lucas at USC won a scholarship to go to work on or be an apprentice on an observer on a production, and he chose Francis's film because he felt like
I've seen those stills, and George is so skinny and little.
They're both skinny.
So skinny. He was so young. It was really, that's kind of shocking, those pictures. He looks like he's about 12.
Yeah, well, he was about 12. He was like 23, and Francis was 26 or something like
Incredible.
That.
I just want to say that I guess with my husband, he was really much more of an overnight kind of thing. When we went from Kentucky Fried Movie to Animal House, and it was such a shock to see people line up to see the movie. What a surprise! Who knew?
Yeah, I know that. I think we had that experience too. Everything was a struggle. When Francis took the Godfather job, we were $400,000 in debt, and he didn't want to do it. He thought it was kind of a sensational book and just kind of a cheap shot or something at the Italian, But we were really in debt. He tried to start this studio in San Francisco, and it hadn't worked out, and George came to me and said, "Francis, you got to do it. You got to take it. You just got to do it, because to get bailed out." So, you never know how those things turn out. And then he, all the time he was making it, he was under a lot of pressure, and people didn't like it. They thought it was too dark, and all these dark scenes and these dark rooms, and what was the matter with him? And just so before the film came out, he took another job, because he was sure he wasn't going to be able to support the family. And he was writing a script in New York, and I remember we were in this hotel, and we looked out the window, and we could see this line around the block for Godfather. And it was kind of a thrilling moment to realize that we were going to get out of debt. And
it was unbelievable.
Carry on.
But it's so amazing how we make movies the same way, and the public makes them hits or flops.
You tried just as hard. Yeah.
It's an incredible thing. The other incredible thing, which I haven't figured out yet, is that if a movie costs $20,000 or $200 million, it costs the same at the box office for the public.
That's right, yeah.
Why is that? I can't, if anyone knows, just tell me later.
I love talking to Deborah, because she's married to a film director, and we have this long history of how this is.
It's so surprising. You never know. And so you looked out the window, and this movie that he almost didn't take became one of the great American movies.
Well, then you have your ups, and then in like 1980, we were in bankruptcy court again. So, you know, don't take things too seriously.
It's an amazing life.
Enjoy the ups, because, you know, there could be downs, and there will be.
I know.
Oh, yeah, these things.
I know already. Yeah. Okay, so let's go to 262.
So now this is November 19th, 2004. Yesterday, Francis and I walked through the big house to see the progress. Oak paneling made from the tree that fell on the house was being applied to the large refrigerator doors. The casings of the new elevator were being clad in mahogany. Two craftsmen were applying panels of silk to the living room walls. Painters hand-rubbed a decorative finish on the foyer walls. Workmen were rehanging our Murano glass chandelier in the dining room. Francis found the fixture in Trieste, Italy, while we were shooting Godfather II years ago. I disliked it and was very discouraging, saying, "We really have no place it would look right." He bought it anyway. Years later, when we moved to Napa, it fit the dining room perfectly, as if it had been custom made. I stepped into my bathroom. It had originally been a large bedroom and now looked particularly enormous. There were two sections of wall with new details I hadn't seen before. There was a marble floor, a differently toned marble wainscoting, a large marble shower, and a marble fireplace. Our Victorian tub sat out in the room, facing toward the view out the tall windows. I'd never been in such a big, elegant bathroom, and I'd traveled the world. I felt I would appear out of place if I wasn't wearing a silk dressing gown trimmed with flowing marabou feathers. This morning over breakfast, Francis talked about how he is searching for a new language of cinema to express time and consciousness. Film is a young art. Do you think everything has already been discovered? No. As I sipped my green tea and he talked about his ideas, I knew how fortunate I was to be part of such a conversation.
And that's the friendship for all the years, starting in Ireland, talking. But it's talking about his work, and does he listen to you? Do you get to talk about his work too?
Yes, but I think I'm the audience, you know. I'm the observer. I mean, he's basically an entertainer, so he tries things out on me, so I do get to...
Yeah, and?
Hear the story. I feel like my life is kind of like a front row seat, you know, all kinds of things, and I'm the observer, and it's had these wonderful opportunities to be in the front row seat.
Well... being in the movie business and certainly being successful in the movie business, one of the amazing things is the access. Mm-hmm. How many places that you've been, how many places I've been. People are interested in people in the movie business when you travel. Think of all the palaces and the places that you've seen, the insides, shooting. You talk about it in the book when you're in Palermo, when you're in Sicily. The Queen of Thailand. So it's the access is really remarkable. Have you found that as well? I mean, that the doors just fly open?
Yes, they do. People all over the world are really interested in the film industry and the people in it. And now Francis is kind of in the grand old man category, and so we get a good table at the restaurants. And
well, that has something to do with you supplying the wine at the restaurants as well.
Yeah. You know.
I think you should talk. I'm interested in that aspect as well, because you said in 1980 you were in the bankruptcy courts. Mm-hmm. You have an incredible vineyard. Can you just tell us when that happened? Because it's a movie business. And then the vineyard, when did that happen? How did that happen?
Well, in 1975, we were looking for a little summer house for our family. We lived in San Francisco, and it's cold there in the summertime, and we wanted to go close by to the Napa Valley where and Francis thought he could get an acre of vineyard, and he could make some home wine, and we'd have this little place there, and... In the course of it, we were shown this property, and the real estate agent said, "This is not for you, this is not what you're looking for, but you should just see it because it'll probably only be open once in our lifetime." And it was the old Inglenook Winery Estate, and we drove into it. It was separated at that time, but so the house and 100 acres of vineyard in this beautiful mountain top was what was for sale. And when we went there, after it just looked like a movie set. It had this beautiful big Victorian house and these rolling lawns and the swimming pool, and it just looked unbelievable. And once Francis had seen that, he wanted it. And it, what can I say? It seemed kind of outrageous at the time, but it cost the same amount as a house in Beverly Hills at that time.
What year was that? Do you remember?
1975, because we couldn't move in. We went to the Philippines, and we moved in after 1977 when we came back from Apocalypse. But let's see. So anyway, it had this vineyard, and Francis realized that it was, as he studied it, that it was a famous vineyard of high quality. He said, you know, you have a great racehorse, you have to race it. So he got a winemaker and started making wine. And it was a kind of a small endeavor for many years. And then in 1995, we were able to acquire the front property, which was the old Inglenook Chateau and the front vineyards and so forth. And we joined these two properties as they had been historically joined. And then he had to really take winemaking seriously. And he did, and it's just been prophetic how all early, before that we'd just been broke and paying off debts from one from the heart and da-da-da-da-da. But in 1991, he did Dracula, or Dracula came out, and it did very, very well. And so we had this little nest egg that we'd put away. So Francis said to me, you know, Ellie, we're just going to put this away, and I'm never going to use it. This is to secure us for the rest of you. I'm not going to make you go to bankruptcy court again. We're not going to have any of these ups and downs. We're going to have this nest egg. And, of course, when this property came available, he said, Ellie, we have to do it. You know, so, but fortunately, the wine industry has really been good for us, and Francis spent a lot of time focused on that during the late 90s and the early 2000s, and really trying to bring back the incredible historical quality and authenticity that this estate had. It kind of fallen into ruin, and it's been his project, but he wants to do these things. You know, he started some resorts in Central America, and just, he has all these things going, but the winery, as it's turned out, he felt like, who would have ever known that the winery would support his film business? Because
yes.
When we first started in the winery thing, the film company was the larger part of the company, and they kept saying, get rid of that winery thing. It's just it's just draining resources, and you should be focusing on one thing. You're a movie maker. Make movies, and don't take your time with this wine business. But as it turned out, the wine business now has taken off and supporting him, making it possible for him to make some low-budget films that he wants to make at this point in time, because in his maturity, he wants to make films that interest him or challenge him, and he's making these low-budget films that
well,
he couldn't do.
Well, there's many a filmmaker in Hollywood with vineyard envy.
Vineyard envy.
We have vineyard. We covet the vineyard. We covet the Paul Newman's pasta sauce.
Right.
We want to get out of this business and have something else. The last reading is among the most meaningful, certainly for me. There are a lot of wonderful moments in this book, and I was touched deeply by it. But the last reading is about the circle of memory. And it's page 189.
Okay. Well, I think I need to say that the book begins with the events surrounding the death of our son, Gio, who died in an accidental boating incident in 1986. And I put it there in the beginning of the book because I feel like it's the undercurrent through my life since then. And this is one of the an art piece that relates to partly how I've dealt with that. January 5th, 2004, Napa. Today I'm putting away several boxes of messages that were gathered from a collaborative art installation I've worked on intermittently for nearly 5 years. The installation is called Circle of Memory, a public space that inspires visitors to remember and commemorate children who are lost or have died. It is in the shape of a cairn and constructed of straw bales. Small pencils and paper are provided for visitors to leave messages to loved ones tucked in the walls. By the closing date, thousands upon thousands of messages were wedged into the straw. I read some. It has been 19 months since you were stabbed by the parking meter. We miss you so much, Mom and Dad. I feel blessed that I have no child's name to place here and thought of those who did. This is my fourth visit. I wish the exhibit was permanent. Davy, it's been 45 years and I still miss you. In the mid-90s, I visited my friend Jean McMahon in Ireland, where she was studying an ancient cairn for a book she was writing. She led me and several others over stiles, across pastures, through flocks of sheep, to the top of a hill where we saw a mound of stones. She told us this was a prehistoric site called a cairn, or passage tomb. She located the crumbling entrance and led us through a low passageway that emerged into a dark round stone chamber with a high domed ceiling. Jean took candles from her backpack and lit a half dozen, setting them on stone ledges. We could see the corbelled ceiling and marveled at the engineering and technology it took to build such a structure long before modern tools. Cairns were built about 5,000 years ago. Jean said, bones were found in perfectly round stones. It is thought that rituals pertaining to death and renewal were performed here. We could see small round holes carved into the large stones that looked as if they would fit a marble, and also complex patterns of spirals cut into the rock. Jean suggested we create a ceremony ourselves to commemorate people who had died that were important to us. We stood in the semi-darkness and took turns saying names of loved ones. We named grandparents and favorite authors. But when I finally said, my son Giancarlo Coppola, I felt unexpected intense emotion, as if I were connected to all the mothers who had lost children down through the ages. Later I thought about how we don't have a place in our culture to evoke this connection and commemorate our children. I wondered if it was the shape of the space that affected me, if the ancients had developed a spiritual technology for celebrating the lives of those who died and healing those who remained that we no longer have. Jean told me, passage tombs of this shape consisting of a low passage leading into a round chamber with a high ceiling are found in Africa, Central Europe, ancient China, and other parts of the world. The experience in that Irish cairn remained with me. 5 years later, my barn studio was built of straw bales. When the walls were up, I found the aroma of the straw, its color and texture so appealing, I wished it wasn't necessary to plaster over them. A year or two later, the thought came to me, if a cairn were made out of straw bales, would it have evocative qualities such as the ones of stone I visited in Ireland? Straw bales are cheap, readily available, and simple to build with, unlike the process of moving huge stones. It could potentially be easily built in any community and be a universal space without religious, political, or ethnic overtones, a space for anyone to commemorate the loss of a child, whether their own or the tragedies we confront almost daily through the media. I consulted with Jean about the possibility of creating a straw bale cairn as an art installation, thinking that people come to art venues with a curious and reflective attitude. We decided to form a collaboration with another artist, as well as an architect, a designer of stage lighting and sets, and a sound designer. The six of us developed the concept over several years, meeting when we found time in everyone's busy schedule. We made a mock-up of the piece on our ranch in an old barn, which Francis uses as a rehearsal space. The day came when Francis said he needed to use the barn and we should dismantle our construction. He had heard me talk about the project, but hadn't seen what we'd made. I called him in his writing bungalow and said, I'd really like you to see what we've worked on before we take it down. I could hear in his voice I'd interrupted him. He said reluctantly, all right. He appeared at the barn door with an expression of, okay, I don't have much time, let's get this over with. When he smelled the straw and saw the form, he visibly slowed down. His body seemed to melt as he moved along the passageway into the darkened chamber and sat down in a straw bale facing the thin stream of salt falling. We six collaborators were there and waited quietly for him to give his critique. He was silent. I looked over and saw a tear roll down his cheek. He said quietly, it works.
And were you able to take that construction other places?
Yes, we did it first in Oakland, and I liked doing it in an urban area where the smell of the aroma of the straw is more powerful than it would be if you did it in the country. And people were walking by to pay their parking tickets, and they came in and had this experience, and it was, I thought, really powerful. And it went, it was so well received that we were invited to take it to San Diego and then to Santa Fe, New Mexico. And last summer it was installed in Montpellier, France, which was even more curious to me to see, confirm that it has a universal appeal, because there were international visitors from many countries that came and left messages in many languages. And this summer it's going to Salzburg, to the festival. So it's continuing.
And it's something you can continue forever.
Yes, we're in conversation with someone in Japan about bringing it there. And I've tried to bring it to Los Angeles, but I haven't had success yet. So we will see.
Well, maybe tonight someone here will
be connected to someone.
Yes, absolutely.
That's what, in case it's confusing to you, what the image is here, but this is the salt falling on my hand. That's part of the center of the cairn. Has this very beautiful lighting with just a stream of light directed onto the salt falling, and it continues to fall during the duration of the installation and just builds in this sort of soft mound and, on the floor. Little kids like to put their hands in the falling salt, and there's a lovely isn't the right word, but a very evocative sound element as you're seated in the interior. Richard Biggs, the Academy Award-winning sound designer, created a tapestry of voices of children saying the alphabet and counting in many languages. And it just kind of comes in and out of one's awareness. And then at the end, as you exit the passageway, you see a bowl pieces of paper and pencils to write notes, and slowly the walls, exterior walls and interior too, of the cairn fill up with these messages, which give it a kind of a powerful interactive experience. And I really intend it to be a kind of a reflective oasis in an urban situation, and for anyone's response, although my purpose or intention is that it's to commemorate the children we've lost. I think it's however a person responds to it. One woman sat down in it and she said, my father started talking to me. And so I think it's whatever response a person has.
It's incredible. Well, it reminds me of a couple of things. It reminds me of churches in Italy, in the middle of cities, where nobody's in the church, and the streets are so crowded. And if you tuck into one of those churches, you're totally alone and you can hear yourself. And this mm-hmm. provides that same kind of space. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. I think we can open for questions now. It's 8 o'clock. Does that sound right, Louise? Thank you very, very much, everyone, for coming.
Thank you.
Louise, are you going to get it organized? Or? All right. This lady in turquoise, just right here, was the first one with her hand up.
Thank you. Beautiful writing. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Documentary filmmaking, any more plans in that arena?
Well, I seem to be the family documentarian. I've made three documentaries about Francis and two about Sophia's work and one about my son Roman's work. And I was just in Argentina, and where Francis is shooting right now, and they brought out the documentary camera and put it in my hand, so there I was. So, yes, I've just continued doing that. And I love that form. I love to look in the viewfinder and just isolate that rectangle of visual image, and it's just a really powerful way to be an observer.
There's a wonderful story that Ellie tells about being on the set of Marie Antoinette, and the stories in the books about how she's a participant and an observer, and in her role as that, she uses both sides of her brain, I think. Next question. Yes, miss. Right up here.
I was thinking you were talking about your daughter when she was a baby, wonderful expression. So what was your feelings when she had a baby, you know, you became a grandmother? Do you have a story about?
Did you hear that? What my feelings about my daughter having a daughter? I was 35 when Sophia was born, and this is getting reverb. Do I have it in the wrong place? Okay. I was 35, and I was walking down the street in New York, and I had our boys on one in each hand, and I was walking with this big belly down the street, and some gentleman yelled out, it wasn't a gentleman, a man yelled out and said, "Haven't you ever heard of overpopulation, lady?" You know, and I was just kind of considered like a really old lady sort of a little bit obscene. Was I still having sex, you know, in this old age, having this child? And now I see Sophia had her first child at 35, and her daughter. So I had my daughter at 35, she had her daughter at 35, and just how the generations have changed. And of course, it's a great thrill and delight to have this new little person in our lives. And I just in March, my daughter lives in Paris. Sophia lives in Paris with her family, and I stopped there on a larger trip. Spent a couple of days, but I was with her, and of course I rang the bell, and I went to the door, and her name is Romy. The baby's name is Romy, and I could hear Sophia saying, "Grandma's here, Grandma's here," and she came to the door and opened the door, and with great delight, she kind of ran out, and then she realized she didn't know me, and she ran back and hugged her mother's leg, because, you know, it had been like 3 months that I'd seen her, and
yes,
kids don't remember that, and so it took like a while for her to warm up to me and to begin to accept me, and then shortly we were in the kitchen, and she was in her high chair, and I was feeding her pureed vegetables, and 4 days later I had come home and was in Los Angeles visiting my mom, who's 99, and a nursing home, and I went there, and I could see my mom in her wheelchair, and I came up to her, and she smiled really sweetly, but I could see that she didn't know me, and it took me like quite a while for her to sort of accept me, and I, you know, little by little, and she said, "Well, I know you're someone I love," and I stayed with her, and then finally she seemed to realize that I was her daughter, and then her dinner was served, and the attendant came and said, "You know, your mom doesn't want to feed herself anymore." So I had never really been there at that time of day, and so there I was, like, feeding my mom her pureed vegetables in her wheelchair. You know, it's like...
So I have
life.
It's incredible. I have a suggestion for Sophia.
Yeah.
You know how in front of movie theaters sometimes they have standees? She could make a cardboard standee of you, Ellie, and just keep it and move it around the apartment, or move it around their house, so that when your granddaughter sees you, when Romy sees you, she'll know that that's Grandma. So just make a standee of Ellie. Next question. More questions? It's quite a life. Yes, right here.
Hello, I just love your book, which I'm reading now. I love your book, Apocalypse Now, which I'm reading for the second time. I shall be getting this one. I too am married to a director. I know what your life is like somewhat. What I want to ask is, where can we see your documentaries? Where are they available?
Oh, thank
you. Good question.
The one that is most known is Hearts of Darkness, and it's just came out on DVD. It's on Amazon.com is for sale, and bundled with it is quite a long, like an hour-long documentary that was shot in Romania while Francis was making his the last film that came out, Youth Without Youth. And it's called Coda 30 Years Later. So you sort of see him in his late 30s, and now you see him in his late 60s. And the two kind of are an interesting, I think, bookends to his career. The other ones I made, one on him working with his actors, because he has these interesting techniques that he uses with his actors to rehearse, and that during the making of The Rainmaker. And it was on HBO and different places, you know, those kind of first look things, but I don't know what's happened to it. I'm thinking I should bundle some of these together.
But Ellie, you can't drop a bomb like he has these interesting techniques. You can't say that. What kind of interesting? I mean, you just told us he has these interesting techniques of working with actors.
Well, sorry, you'll have to see.
No. Can't you give us something? Come on.
They're theater techniques to relax the actors and get them to focus and concentrate, and they're kind of classic theater things, but people in movies don't usually use that. Usually the rehearsals are you read the script and you work with the script and you practice the script, but he does a lot of theater things.
He also rehearses.
He really rehearses with his actors, because that's to him in a way, the most important part is like what the actors are doing, and it's not just the special effects. It's kind of
It's funny that he and George are so close.
Well, Francis is always getting on George's case about how his actors are wooden. George doesn't care. He doesn't want to be bothered with the actors at all. He just. And finally, Francis talked him on his last Star Wars film, which you may or may not think is more well acted. He sent an acting coach to to work with the actors for George, because he felt like that was really a missing.
Was that like a film gift? the acting coach showed up.
He sort of twisted his arm and made him hire the acting coach.
Okay, then.
Also, I guess to finish that question off, the documentary I shot about Sophia making Marie Antoinette is on the DVD of Marie Antoinette, and the one I shot on Roman is on his film, the DVD of CQ, and I think the Virgin Suicides one is on that DVD. They're mostly now on the DVDs.
You know, I'm glad you brought up Roman. Mm-hmm. Because we've talked about Sophia and we've talked about Francis, and the audience may not be as familiar with Roman. Mm-hmm. Can you tell us about that good-looking boy?
He is 6 years older than Sophia, and he's been involved in the film business since he was 16. He was he went on a film, The Black Stallion Returns, at 16, and he was working with the makeup man, and his job was to braid the horse's manes or something, and I don't know, he had these crazy things he did because he was just a kid and they were forced to take him along because Francis asked him to take him. But while he was there, he slowly became the assistant to the sound person taking the sound, in charge of the sound. And then the sound guy was from England, and he got some illness because they were shooting in Morocco, and he was sent back to England, and Roman was just the only person there, so he had to kind of take over for a few weeks while they found the next sound guy, or the other guy got well and came back. And the guy never got well enough, but the point they realized they had to hire somebody new, Roman had taken over the department and was doing professional sound work for the production. So he's lived on sets and worked on many, many, many films, and he's directed one feature film and many music videos and commercials that are highly regarded and award-winning. And he's a great heart. He'll go to Sophia's film and shoot the second camera. He's on all of her films. She said, Roman, I need you, I need you. And they have such a dear, sweet connection, and Sophia knows that if she asks Roman to get something, that it'll be just what she needs. I was in Roman's office, and there was some things up on the monitor. He was putting together some little reel of stuff he's done, and there's this iconic image of Bill Murray riding in the car in Lost in Translation, riding in the streets of Tokyo with the buildings going by, and those are all images that Roman shot. So I love how they work together, and now Roman's just gotten the call from Francis saying, I need you, come to Argentina, I need you next Thursday for something. So there's this back and forth in the family he does, but we're all kind of kicking him to do his own project because he helps everybody else, and it's time he not stop being so generous and focus on his own work.
Another question? Okay, right here. Thank you, Luis.
I remember when Godfather 3 came out, and there was there's a lot of controversy about the movie, particularly Sophia being cast in it. Mm-hmm. And I wonder how you, as her mother, felt about that, or how the family felt about that.
That's a good story.
Yeah, well, you'll have to read the book.
That story is in the book. And there's a lot of emotionality that went on during that time, interfamily emotionality. And it is a wonderful story, and she does cover it so beautifully. I guess we have to move on. What's the next question? Got to read the book. Yes, sir.
Mrs. Colbert, thanks so much for coming by. Quick question. Is there a comedian in the family?
A comedian?
Has any member of the Colbert family directed, produced, or written? I'm referencing a little bit of Mr. Coppola's, I believe, Italian ancestry, right? Commedia dell'arte. Where did I read somewhere that he was thinking about doing it, and he's still thinking about doing something? Am I right? No.
No?
About doing a comedy?
Yeah.
Well, I think some of his films have strong comedic elements and things like that. Peggy Sue Got Married and things like that are definitely that aspect. Are you saying are you asking if there's a comic in the family or something? Is that?
Yeah, more in terms of the type of film that's being made. Mr. Coppola's known as a pretty dramatic type of comedy. I know Sophia's come out with a couple movies that's been very successful. I'm not as familiar with Roman's work, but he kind of summarized it for us. It just appeared in hearing you in the last few minutes. That's almost like the shot of something that the family needed.
Shot of comedy. Well, we have our wonderful nephew, Jason Schwartzman, who is, I think, the comic, as in the family anyway, he's the comic relief. And
yes.
Right, and he's Talia Shire's son.
Yeah, Francis' sister, Talia Shire's son, two sons are. I was counting up how many people in the family somehow are involved in this family business, it seems like. It feels like. Because I think they're about 13. And not only, all the obvious ones that we know about, My brother is a special effects cinematographer, and I mean, it just goes on and on.
Wow. Well, it's the artistic and the visual.
The visual. It's really, yeah. Yeah.
One more question. Yes. Yes. Thank you.
Which is the Italian quality of your husband that you admire more than the others because it reflects the art and the roots of his family, music included?
Well, for me, I always tell women that they should find a man who can cook and sing. These are the things that sustain you for the long haul.
Ellie spends a lot of time in the kitchen talking about Frances cooking. The other wonderful thing is how much time she spends in the book, and this goes back to nature. This vineyard and this farm, they're picking their own vegetables. And Frances is cooking what's coming out of the garden, fresh. And he's making pasta for his cast, right?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And his crew. And it's an extended family. I mean, it really reads good. I mean, I wanted to be there. So I wanted to be at that table with all of you.
Well, there is a lot of our life, family lifestyle and even professional lifestyle that takes place around the dinner table or the lunch table or whatever. In fact, my editor, she edited out some food scenes because she said there's just too many food scenes in here.
Between the food and the wine, where's the movie business?
Yeah, right.
If there are no other questions, we're going to say thank you so much. And
thank you. Thank you so much for coming. Thank you. Thank you.
Aloud Audio is presented by the Library Foundation of Los Angeles and made possible through support provided by the Ralph M. Parsons Foundation, the Annenberg Foundation, City National Bank, contributors to the Stay Home and Read a Book Ball, Donna and Martin J. Wolf, and the law firm Arendt Fox. Media support provided by KPCC 89.3 FM, KUSC 91.5 FM, and KCET. Aloud theme composed by Larry Karish.